This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, March 21st. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On April 9th, Israel will hold a general election, which could topple Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He is facing serious corruption charges, and he's been widely condemned for his formal alliance with three extreme right-wing political parties. A new political party, Blue and White, made up of centrists and former military officers, is doing its best to exploit Netanyahu's vulnerabilities. At a press conference announcing the formation of Blue and White, one of its leaders, Benny Gantz, had this to say about the party.
We felt and said in the last decade something went wrong. Israel lost its way. The government created disputes and divided a good, intelligent people. A government of divide and conquer that tears people apart, that tears us apart. An evil wind walked the streets, and we are here to say enough is enough.
Bernard Avishai joins me from Jerusalem to discuss what to watch for in the weeks ahead and what lessons the election may hold for those observing from abroad. Bernie, welcome.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Could you bring us up to date briefly on Netanyahu's legal problems, which we've been following over here with some interest?
Right. Well, what has happened is that the Attorney General has made clear that he will indict him on various charges pending a hearing. That hearing will take place in July. There are three charges against him. In two of the cases, he's accused of trying to manipulate the press by entering into shady deals with various editors and or heads of media companies. In one of them, he's accused of having taken enormous gifts from, in one case, a Hollywood mogul, in one case, an Australian mogul, both of whom got different kinds of favors. These are pretty difficult charges. And in all cases, there have been people who have turned state's evidence, and it's pretty clear that he will in fact be indicted after his hearing. The thing is that that hearing is in July and the election's in April. So people are going to the polls knowing that Netanyahu is A, denying all charges, B, that he will have 3 or 4 months to form a government in advance of the hearing, and that he will be able to pass laws between now and then that might make it much more difficult to force his resignation.
How has he been able to maintain public support throughout this scandal?
Well, you know, Trump says that he can shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and his people will still vote for him. Netanyahu has a kind of cult following much like that. Likud has been in power for really since 1977, except for one or two exceptional times. And they have a base. It's a base of immigrants from the North African countries, some other Middle Eastern countries, who came in the 1950s and 60s and have a kind of resentment for the European elite that was here before. It's a little like, you know, how people in South Boston felt about the white Protestant community of Boston in the late 19th century. And there are also Russians who came and didn't like the smell of social democratic politics on the so-called left. But it's really a kind of anti-elitist populism that's very familiar to Americans. You have to remember only about 30% of Israelis have college degrees. There are a lot of people who feel that they're being left out of this globalizing trend. And Israel's a very globalized economy, and there's some people getting rich and some people who are not.
So over here, as you know, there's enormous anticipation about the release of the Mueller report and about whether a sitting U.S. president can be indicted. What are the chances that the charges against Netanyahu will be dismissed? And could he be brought to trial while still in office?
The chances of the charges being dismissed are almost nil. The chances of the Knesset creating new legislation to make it unnecessary for a sitting prime minister to resign are higher and higher if he's reelected. In fact, it's quite possible there will be a fourth charge against Netanyahu on a much, much more serious issue, where he is suspected plausibly for having profited from the sale of vessels to the Israeli military from the German company ThyssenKrupp. He apparently was invested in one of the suppliers to ThyssenKrupp. He bucked the defense establishment's recommendations in order to acquire vessels that they said Israel didn't need, and apparently pocketed something like $4.5 million. It's a much bigger deal. And part of the reason why you have three generals running against him is because he has so enraged the defense and intelligence community that they would like to see yet another indictment against him on a far more serious charge.
So tell us about the Blue and White Party, who its leaders are and what sort of platform it's running on.
Well, the Blue and White Party is a very contrived ersatz party that came together in the last couple of months. They claim to be, as it were, centrists. It's pretty hard to know what that really means. They are not identified with the Oslo process. They are skeptical of any kind of Israeli initiative to engage with the Palestinian leadership. And on the other hand, they're not prepared to say that in the absence of a deal with the Palestinians, Israel should embark on a settlement project that will preempt any future negotiation. So I think that's the closest I can come to describing what the center is. In terms of political economy, they're pretty much the same as Labor and even much of the Likud.
And Benny Gantz, who's new to politics, was an IDF chief of staff not so very long ago. And obviously, security is a huge issue in Israeli politics. Are there any apprehensions about many of their top brass being ex-military?
People like Benny Gantz represent the state institutions that they've devoted their lives to. The IDF is a people's army. About 60% of the young people in this country serve. So they are custodians of our kids, and they have given their lives to these state institutions and feel themselves that they have to protect them. Also, they're people who come from the old labor agricultural settlements. Their pedigree is back to the old labor governments of the 60s. When they explain the animating principle of their party, they always use the term mamlachtiut. Mamlachtiut means a kind of reverence for state institutions. I think that they see themselves as a kind of stop, a kind of break on a danger that Netanyahu, in hugging the right and going further and further right in order to remain in office, is willing to make common cause with Kahanists and people whose association with former Jewish terrorist organizations and Jews who are utterly identified with the settler movement. Those people have to be stopped, in their view. They regard themselves a little like the way I imagine McMaster, Kelly, Mattis regarded themselves, as protectors of the Constitution in the face of someone who seemed capable of drawing way outside the lines.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So Trump, in his ongoing bromance with Netanyahu, has promised in his usual very low-keyed way a Mideast peace plan that he calls the deal of the century, headed, of course, by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And as I gather, it's to be unveiled after the Israeli election. What is the word in Jerusalem about what this deal might consist of?
Well, most people assume that Trump is going to try to revive something like the Jordan option of the 1970s. In other words, the Palestinians get areas of autonomy, their diplomatic interests are represented by the Jordanians, Israel remains in the Jordan Valley, and these areas of autonomy are really restricted to what would be called areas A and B under Oslo, which are essentially concentric circles around populated areas of the West Bank. Area C, which is 62% of that territory, would be slowly annexed to the Israeli state. I think that's what's understood. But I think there's also talk in the Kushner plan that that annexation would not come immediately. There's even some talk about land swaps that will allow the Palestinians to have more territory from the Sinai. The Egyptians would have to be on board with that. We don't really know what this plan is going to look like, but it's clearly very comfortable for Netanyahu and his government to anticipate what this plan is going to be. Jerusalem has already, in effect, been given over to Israel from the Trump administration. It's pretty clear Trump wants to see Netanyahu reelected, and I don't think there's going to be anything in the peace plan that's going to make any kind of embarrassment for him.
I know you've been following the uproar over Representative Ilhan Omar's comments about AIPAC and Israeli money in American politics, which drew charges of anti-Semitism. Can you talk a little bit about that from Israel's perspective?
Israelis will always quickly come together to condemn any American politician that raises the specter of dual loyalty. What's interesting is that the way in which Netanyahu has framed Jewish self-determination really emanating from a world Jewish people, and that he somehow is the determiner of the Jewish self in self-determination, and that somehow Jews who are members of the Jewish people more broadly are imminently members of the Jewish nation. If you take Likud ideology and Netanyahu ideology seriously, dual loyalty is a kind of corollary. So Israelis on the one hand feel that anybody who speaks of dual loyalty, anyone who embarrasses Israel in any way in the American political theater, is obviously an anti-Semite. It kind of works with their sense of being embattled, besieged, both historically and geographically. But what's interesting to me is that Netanyahu has projected a conception of Jewish peoplehood leading to nationhood of which he is custodian.
And Republicans here have embraced that, Trump foremost among them, and leapt all over this as an issue they rightly saw could be exploited politically. And, of course, smearing the entire Democratic Party as a result, notwithstanding the fact that so many Jewish people in America are Democrats.
Yes. And the irony is that the Democrats would find it much easier to defend an Israel consistent with democratic norms if Netanyahu were not constantly debasing the idea of Israeliness.
So interesting.
You know, it's Israeliness that Netanyahu and his government have been railing at. And the reason why is because they're afraid that Israeliness, the idea that to be a citizen of this country, to be participant in Hebrew civil society, if that is the basis for national life here, well, then Arabs are part of it, that Arabs are part of the Israeli nation. Netanyahu has really made his campaign trying to discredit Gantz by implying that in order for Gantz to actually get to 61 seats in a 120-seat Knesset, he's going to have to rely on Arab votes. And he's not wrong about that. If Gantz is going to get the leverage to actually form the next government, he's going to have to get the tacit, at least, approval of the Arab parties in order to get the mandate from the president to form a coalition.
And he was speaking about exactly that in that clip we played at the top about the government of divide and conquer that tears people apart. It seemed to me that he was striking exactly that note.
Yes, and he's put Gantz in a corner.
And so what are the chances that this new party could bring an end to Netanyahu's long rule?
It's a statistical toss-up at this point. According to the polls, Likud and Blue and White are pretty much running neck and neck to have the plurality, each around 30, 34 seats. But in order to get the president to give you the mandate, you have to be able to prove that there are parties in the Knesset that will give you a majority. So even if you have the most seats, if you have the plurality, you don't necessarily get the presidential mandate. And now we get to yet another really interesting quirk of the Israeli electoral system. In order to get into the Knesset, you need 3.25% of the total vote. That's about four seats. There are five parties right now that are hovering around the threshold. If you don't get 3.25% of the vote, all of your votes are lost. In effect, all of those voters don't count. So if right-wing parties that are hovering around the threshold don't get in, even if Netanyahu has a plurality, he may not be able to get to 61. The same is true also for Gantz. Gantz could have a plurality, but if left-wing parties like Meretz don't clear this threshold, all of those votes are lost, and that means four seats for the bloc that he would have to put together to get to 61.
So presumably one of Netanyahu's missions in his meeting with Trump at the White House is to appeal to his base in the weeks before the election. Will this affiliation with Trump help him beyond that part of the electorate?
For Netanyahu's voters, and maybe even for some swing voters, appearing at the White House is going to be a bump for him, no question about it. There's even some rumor here that Trump may commute the sentence of Jonathan Pollard. Pollard, of course, was the American spy who was spying on behalf of Israel and just got out of prison 4 years ago, but is still on parole and can't leave the country. So if Trump commutes that sentence and allow Netanyahu to bring Pollard back to Israel, obviously it'll be a big boost for him. And Trump knows it. And Bibi knows it.
Thank you so much, Bernie.
Thanks, Dorothy. Thanks so much.
Bernard Avishai is a contributor to NewYorker.com and the author of, among other books, The Tragedy of Zionism, How Its Revolutionary Past Haunts Israeli Democracy. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review this program on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com with assistance from Kylie Warner. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.